Good afternoon. Welcome to a Thursday, November 12, 2020 edition of Ozarks at Large. This is 91.3 KUAF, a listener-supported service of the School of Journalism and Strategic Media at the University of Arkansas. On today's show, another part of life changed by the continuing pandemic, taking those standardized tests that help determine college admissions. Ozarks at Large's Daniel Carruth reports that taking and preparing for the ACT is different in 2020. And we find out more about how the virus is creating immediate changes for the Siloam Springs School District. Tuesday, Governor Asa Hutchinson predicted already high case numbers of COVID-19 would probably increase as the week continued, and he was right. The Arkansas Department of Health reports just more than 1,200 new confirmed cases of the virus in the most recent 24-hour monitoring period, and another 755 probable cases for a total of 1,962 cases. It's another single-day record for the state. The five single highest new case total days have all been recorded in the past 7 days. Arkansas's death from coronavirus increased by 13 confirmed deaths among Arkansans and one probable death. There are 13,691 active cases. The ADH is reporting there are 801 patients hospitalized in Arkansas because of complications from the virus. That's a slight decrease from Tuesday's record of 810. A live virtual meeting regarding the proposed Illinois River Bridge replacement on Highway 59 in Siloam Springs begins at 5:30 this evening, hosted by the Arkansas Department of Transportation. The public is invited to watch, listen, and provide written comments during this 60-minute meeting. Participants will need to use a link found at arkansashighways.com to be part of the meeting. That link found under the upcoming events heading. Northwest Arkansas Community College will host a free family night at the 112 Drive-In on November 19th. The movie Sing will be screened. Registration can be found by going to nwac.edu. First 100 cars to register will receive a free blanket. It will be November 19th, after all. And not a bad idea to have a blanket handy tonight. The National Weather Service expects lows around 34 in northwest Arkansas and in the lower 40s tonight in the Arkansas River Valley. There is also a 20% chance of rain tonight in the River Valley. Tomorrow, sunny in northwest Arkansas with highs around 60. Few clouds and a slight chance of rain tomorrow in the River Valley with highs in the lower 60s. This is Ozarks at Large. If the mounting stress of a global health crisis isn't enough for you, try juggling high school and college application season. As the fall semester winds down, a lot of students, who've had a turbulent year to say the least, are scrambling to get college ready. Ozarks at Large's Daniel Carruth explains how a major factor, ACT testing, has changed during the pandemic.
It's 5:30 on Tuesday night, and high school student Ella Flesher is waiting on her most recent ACT test scores at her kitchen table when a message pops up on her phone.
What? They have a queue. ACT now has a queue for looking at your scores.
Flesher is a senior at Haas Hall Academy in Fayetteville, except this year she's not actually at Haas Hall, because she's taking all of her classes online. And she says navigating that new way of schooling while also preparing and applying for college has been stressful.
Managing my time is the most difficult part of this, I think. And there are so many like technology errors that it makes it even harder to contact people because of the pandemic and just make sure I have everything together.
She says some of those technological hiccups happened when she was registering for her most recent ACT test this summer.
I'm not going to lie, it wasn't great because they recently switched over to a new platform, so they made an entirely new way to like access scores, register for the ACT, all of that. And so I had to transfer my old account into this new platform, and there were just so many technical difficulties. It was just really, really stressful. And so we went through so many email rabbit holes, and so they finally just gave me a test for free, actually. So that was good, but, you know, just that we had to contact so many people was really frustrating.
Catherine Hoffman is the vice president of state and federal programs with ACT, and she says other students had similar issues as Flesher.
We did have some challenges this summer with that. We have moved to stabilize our system, so students shouldn't have any problem entering MyACT and registering at this time. And when we recognized that students had that challenge, that is when we increased to 7 test dates for this fall and then 1 in December, just to give some students some more time because they weren't able to get in with the excellence that ACT is committed to this summer. There were some challenges getting into our MyACT account. So we've stabilized that. There should be no issues now with students going in and registering and being able to do that.
Hoffman says 2020 has been a particularly challenging year for the ACT because of COVID-19. In the spring, ACT canceled all of its exam dates nationally as schools and testing sites shut down.
When we did that, however, we offered some different options. We added a June test date for state. We also added a June and July test date for our national test dates. We also added 7 national test dates in September and October on Saturdays and Sundays. And we created 3 state testing dates in the fall for state testing, 1 in September and 2 in October, all Tuesdays. So between those first week of June test dates all the way till the last week of October test dates, we had a little over 700,000 students test during that time frame. So even though I know there were a lot of challenges and a lot of test centers closing where students couldn't get in, unfortunately, we were able to test well over 700,000 students during a pandemic.
Now she says the testing company is working on ways to be more accessible for students and prepare for the possibility of more school closures.
We are doing a beta test of remote proctoring to have that available if needed. Again, if schools begin to close down or we have test centers that aren't willing to open, we could have a remote proctored version of online for the ACT.
And Hoffman says another alternative ACT is experimenting with are new pop-up testing sites to allow room for more students with appropriate social distance. The company started pop-up trials in 8 states this September.
So we have engaged with some hotels, some ballrooms, and different things and provided pop-up sites. And once those sites reach about 80%, we cap it and reserve the remaining 20% for students who may be displaced due to site closures. So those have been very successful for us because, again, in that instance, we control whether that site's going to be open or not, where if it's at a college or a university, they make that choice. And then it really allows for nice social distancing of the students because it is such a large space to make sure that we're utilizing all the CDC recommendations of masks and correct social distancing. So our proctors felt like it went very well, and we were able to, you know, test thousands of students in those ways in which maybe they wouldn't have been able to get in otherwise.
Beyond safety, other barriers to taking the ACT have been exaggerated by the pandemic, especially for low-income students. The cost of a single ACT test for students is $52, and $68 if you also take the writing portion of the test. And that doesn't include fees for accessing and sending test scores. But Hoffman says ACT offers some relief for students who need it.
So every student gets 4 free score reports. So when they take the test, they can send their score to 4 colleges and universities or whomever they choose to for free. If you are a free and reduced lunch student, you can take the ACT for free up to 4 times during your high school career, twice your junior year and twice your senior year. So for those students, if you're a free and reduced lunch student, you simply go to your school and let them know you want a voucher for the ACT, and they provide you one. And you can take the ACT on any Saturday of your choice for free.
And when it comes to college admissions, some schools have already decided to drop mandatory ACT or SAT test scores for the 2021 fall semester. Suzanne McRae is the Vice Provost for Enrollment and Dean of Admissions at the University of Arkansas.
The pandemic has really had the biggest impact on students applying to be freshmen or new students for the fall of 2021. Students haven't been able to take tests, ACT, SAT exams in the way they normally would. They had pass-fail grades in the spring. They're doing a lot of work online. They've really endured quite a disruption as far as preparing for that next step from going from high school to going to college. So we've tried to do several things to help them. We've become test optional for admission. We are offering some of our scholarships based on GPA as opposed to ACT. And we have also offered some free application days for students who may have had a really terrible time as far as their parents losing their jobs, where $40 can seem significant and may slow down their process for applying.
But not all universities have adopted this policy, and students applying for other scholarships like the Arkansas Challenge or Lottery Scholarship still need to have an ACT score just to be eligible. Ella Flesher says the ACT exam has become so connected to college admission, she would be wary to apply without one.
Honestly, I'm still kind of skeptical about not submitting my scores to colleges. So I'm just going to go ahead and submit my scores. It just gives me an edge, especially when it comes to, you know, the competitiveness of scholarships.
For Ozarks at Large, I'm Daniel Carruth.
Students and staff at two schools in the Siloam Springs School District have had to shift to 2 weeks of virtual learning this month after dozens of them either tested positive for COVID-19 or had to go into quarantine because of possible exposure. Superintendent Jody Wiggins says Northside Elementary, which is a small building for kindergarten and pre-K students, moved to off-site instruction first on November 2nd after several staff members came down with the virus.
We had enough staff members that tested positive and or were quarantined that we could not carry forward with our pre-K classes especially. In that case, we actually, to my knowledge, we did not have any positive cases in our student population from that. The second school was this past week. We started having a high number of positives within our student population at our intermediate school, which is fifth and sixth grade. This recent spike in Northwest Arkansas has hit us very hard.
At the intermediate school, about 180 students either tested positive for COVID-19 or were exposed to it. That's roughly a quarter of the student population. 9 of the 45 staff members have also been impacted. Wiggins says the school district consulted with both the Arkansas Department of Education and Department of Health on the closures.
Up until about 2 weeks ago, I could have said that I was almost 100% positive that we did not have any spread in our schools. I'm not sure that I can say that now. I believe that we did have spread within our faculty at Northside there, and then possibly within our student body at intermediate school. So that's the reason that we shut both buildings down, because we were afraid that we were having spread in the school. And the health department seemed to agree with that, because our data did not match up with community data at the time.
Northside Elementary will be back to on-site instruction this coming Monday, November 16th, but staff and students won't be returning to the intermediate school building until after the Thanksgiving holiday. Wiggins says going to virtual learning was not an easy decision to make because of how many people it impacts across Siloam Springs.
It puts a strain on our families, our parents, and to some degree, our employers in our town, because if we're sending students home, then someone has to take care of them. And if they have jobs, then that puts our employers in a bad position. So that's a tough decision to make. From an academic standpoint or academic side, remote learning is not our ideal choice for the way to educate children. We would prefer to do that in person. but our kids and our families have responded in a positive way to both of these closures.
Students were given technology devices to learn from home, and teachers are providing lessons remotely. Wiggins says participation has been good, but that's not the case for every student, especially the younger children, so it's possible there will be some catching up to do when they are back in the school buildings.
You know, some of our parents have to rely on other family members to supervise, whether that be grandparents or aunts or uncles or something like that. And sometimes that process just breaks down in trying to get those students online and involved in the learning.
Wiggins says it's difficult to know where the initial cases originated or how the virus spread through the school, but the district has been taking all the precautions recommended by the Departments of Health and Education. Students and staff at the district's five other campuses are continuing to attend school on site.
2021 gift memberships to the Scott Family Amazium are now available. Amazium members can explore interactive experiences in the arts and sciences throughout the year with special hours and a variety of membership benefits. More information available at amazium.org. As the state's fastest growing region, quality healthcare professionals are essential. UAMS Northwest Regional Campus in Fayetteville is educating the future of healthcare. UAMS.info/future for information.
This autumn, the Design Excellence Program part of the Walton Family Foundation announced three new recipients for grants, that will be used to enhance public spaces in Northwest Arkansas. The latest round of grants will aid in the enhancement of the Jones Center's 52-acre campus in Springdale, the design of the commons in the quilt of downtown parks in Bentonville, and a reimagining of alleys in downtown Springdale. We recently contacted Karen Minkle, Home Region Program Director at the Walton Family Foundation, to talk about the importance of design of public spaces in the region and about the evolution of projects receiving grants from the Design Excellence Program. I asked her via Zoom about the reimagining of alleys in downtown Rogers.
I'm really excited about this project as well, which is really city-driven. I think it was the idea was, how can we use this space differently and creatively? I think there's actually been an evolution in some ways of the Design Excellence Program, because when I think of the kickoff, the projects felt a bit more conventional. I mean, I think the design was exciting, and conceptually, and then the way they've been built is engaging. And you know, the design ranks among some of the best designs across the country, even in the world. However, I think that what we're seeing emerge now are possibilities that may not have been thought about when the program first launched, which is, how can you take spaces like alleys and reinvent them in ways that engage the community, invite social gatherings, but in ways that are, especially in the time of COVID, socially distance, or enable for the feeling of community and yet, you know, remaining safe in terms from a public health perspective. So I think there's a lot of exciting ways to think about design of our outdoor spaces, especially in this moment.
It's interesting you bring that up. I hadn't even thought about, you know, the social distancing that we've been doing for 8 months now in COVID. And there's no way we can know this, of course, but that sort of might influence how we go forward. I mean, you can't have a year like this, and we don't know how long it's going to go, without it having some influence on how people think about spaces, especially outdoor spaces, I guess.
I think that's exactly right. I was at a conference where I was on a panel talking about the Design Excellence Project, or Design Excellence Program, and we had one of the lead researchers from Gale on the panel, as well as an architect and grantee represented. And we were talking about how in moments when there are huge disruptions, there is often a moment following where there is a burst of creativity and problem solving. And the solutions generated are often long-lasting. And that was something that Matt Lister, who with Gail was really emphasizing, where he said, you know, if you think about September 11th, for example, and what happened in terms of the design of our public spaces, you think about like the bollards and how we stopped entering buildings from the, especially some of the old historic federal buildings, and you had to begin entering through the basement. And you really, it changed the way we use the space in a really fundamental way. His point was that we still use the space in that way, that, you know, 20 years later, we haven't necessarily questioned the design of those things. And I think his point was that as we think about, especially our outdoor gathering spaces in this moment, there is a call for rethinking the design of those spaces. And I think his point was that the decisions that we make now as communities will probably stay with us for well past the COVID moment.
You mentioned earlier that the first projects picked for the Design Excellence Program, well, the designs weren't conventional, maybe the spaces were, and now it's getting a little less conventional with alleys and such. That seems like a natural evolution, that maybe some people have seen the first few and that awakens some imagination or removes some doubt or barriers that, well, let's try this.
I think that's right. I think that, you know, I was reflecting on the report before our conversation and thinking about how it's informative, not just for the Design Excellence Program, but really for any organization, any community that's thinking about how they're designing their public buildings and spaces, because it's an ongoing process. And so I hope that in some ways just the Design Excellence Program gives municipalities, it gives nonprofit organizations maybe an opportunity to take a bit of risk in terms of thinking about the spaces that could be designed differently or be invested in that may not be part of what you think would be a conventional investment.
And all three of the projects named this year seem to build on something that is already successful and exists. Downtown Rogers has had a resurgence, the alleys there. Jones Center has been around for a while, you know, rethinking that 52-acre campus. And the last one, which is, I got to look at this, design of the commons in the Quilted Parks, which is extending the Bentonville Square, which has seen, you know, in the last 10 years, such an uptick in activity and foot traffic.
Absolutely. Well, and I would say those, the three projects are building on, you're exactly right, they're building on momentum in those downtowns and a recognition of the spaces that are really popular are often over capacity during peak times. And they're really thinking about what that means. And I think all the communities are thinking about, oh, well, it means we probably need more of these spaces in that area. And I think they're also, the momentum's coming from new amenities and places and spaces that have been added to those downtowns, certainly over the last 5 years, that make it a more and more popular destination. So I think these projects are definitely capitalizing on that momentum and foot traffic.
Finally, I suppose some people will see this as a Springdale project, a Bentonville project, and a Rogers project. But when you think about the things that are happening around Northwest Arkansas, be it the Arts Corridor that's in Fayetteville, the new T2 building, expansion of libraries, yes, this does represent a project in Springdale, in Bentonville, and in Rogers. But the greater thought behind this entire program, right, is about Northwest Arkansas.
The program definitely is in support of the entire region. And I think that the report makes some important points when it talks about some of the challenges or some of the ways in which the program can improve, because it specifically mentions that no matter the aspirations of an individual project to be pedestrian friendly or to be inclusive in terms of inviting different people from all walks of life into this space, that the connective tissue in the region matters. So, you know, if a project has aspirations to be walkable, if there aren't sidewalks, right, connecting this destination several, you know, to the blocks adjacent, then you aren't going to be able to maybe maximize your potential. And, you know, in the report, it talks about the specifically mobility, right? Mm-hmm. Whether that's lack of sidewalks or lack of transit. So I think it is definitely meant to serve the entire region. And I think it also suggests that a program like this can't stand alone, that you need regional solutions in order to really maximize the potential of so many of these places and spaces that have become destinations.
Karen Minkle is Home Region Program Director at the Walton Family Foundation. Our conversation about the Design Excellence Program and this year's grantees, conducted last week via Zoom. This is a Thursday edition of Ozarks at Large. The Oklahoma State Department of Health is adding 11 additional deaths from the virus in the state. They were recorded during the most recent 24-hour data gathering period, but none of those deaths happened in the last 24 hours. The state has now had 1,481 confirmed deaths from COVID-19. Nine of those most recent 11 recorded deaths were in people 65 and older, the other two victims between the ages of 50 and 64. In that same reporting period, Oklahoma officials said there were more than 2,300 new cases of the disease diagnosed in Oklahoma. There are now nearly 23,000 active cases of COVID-19 in that state.
Welcome to today's Northwest Arkansas Business Journal Report. I'm Paul Gatling. Earlier this week at NWABusinessJournal.com, we reported details of an acquisition involving retail technology company Rich Context in Rogers. Rich Context is now owned by The Stable. That's a consumer brand agency based in Minneapolis with additional offices in Seattle and Austin, Texas. On the program today, we'll get some insight into that deal from Rich Context co-founder Billy Courtney, one of three entrepreneurs who started the business in 2016. That interview, plus a rundown of other business headlines, are on the way next after the break on this edition of the Northwest Arkansas Business Journal Report.
Support for the Northwest Arkansas Business Journal Report is provided by the Arkansas State Chamber of Commerce and Associated Industries of Arkansas. The Chamber's mission is to promote a pro-business, free enterprise agenda and prevent legislation, regulation, and rules that hinder business. ArkansasStateChamber.com. Arkansas Blue Cross and Blue Shield. For more than 70 years, Arkansas Blue Cross and Blue Shield has used its knowledge and compassion to create healthcare solutions for individuals and businesses. More information at ArkansasBlueCross.com. First Security is proud to be only in Arkansas. They offer smart solutions for personal and business banking, plus convenient services and community investment. First Security, member FDIC, equal housing lender.
Consumer brand agency The Stable is acquiring Rogers-based e-commerce technology company Rich Context. Founded in 2016, Rich Context Digital Technology engages customers and drives them to buy products online for more than 200 clients, including General Mills, Johnson & Johnson, Nestle, and Hasbro. For more of the company's history and what the acquisition means moving forward, here's Rich Context co-founder Billy Courtney.
Look, at the time, we were, myself, Brett Kelly, and Troy Gagne, we were all working for a large beverage manufacturer and honestly trying to sell beverages online to Walmart. And, you know, one of the things we were bumping into was just a lot of headwind and challenges in terms of just getting items set up, getting basic content. And you know, basically it's like, how is it you can work for such a big company trying to push content to the world's largest retailer? And there are so many headwinds. And so it was kind of out of that experience was ultimately born the idea of, like, let's just create a company that can build new technology and then start there, but ultimately kind of redefine how any brand can go to market with any retailer, as the online shopping experience was just a bit lackluster at the time. And so we decided to build a technology company that helped brands just like us at the time have a little more control and then ultimately just shape and have some more ownership over the digital path to purchase.
Right, sure. And so now you build those software products to help both suppliers and retailers. I think 3 years ago you were working with, I think, 10 brands. And today, you know, your company is working with, you know, over 200 companies, you know, General Mills and Johnson & Johnson and Nestle, Kimberly-Clark, on and on. How did you do that? How did you make those connections and grow the business to what it is today?
Sure. So we actually were kind of in stealth mode, operating only on like word of mouth and doing some of that in the early days. And then you really started to turn it up when we were launching and naming and some of our new technology, and then getting into a space where, you know, what we found with working with some of these initial brands was, you know, the problems that we were seeing in the food category weren't too dissimilar from what we're seeing in consumer electronics and then elsewhere throughout the box in beauty. And so it just seemed as if as we were building the company, we had to shift, you know, it seemed like every year. And every year we were developing some new piece of ad tech. And it just, what we found is that it was always a similar issue, no matter what category a brand was in, of how do I just have more data? How do I have more control and really meet the consumer in a different way digitally? And so, yeah, the growth came through, you know, ultimately it was just a lot of inbound in terms of like, hey, you guys are doing really cool work with this brand. I'm curious what you're doing. And it sounds like it fits, you know, what we're looking for. And that became a big part of it. And as you know, even in this community, you're always one degree away from someone who works somewhere else. And so the good word got out quickly and the business grew as a result.
Yeah, it's a good point. And I guess among those who were curious and the word got out to was The Stable. Tell us a little bit about that company, what they do, and just why this is a good and valuable deal for both sides.
Sure, absolutely. So we've been working well beyond just the Walmart, Sam's Club world and really started to integrate other retailers like Kroger and Target and Best Buy and Amazon. And so as we integrated into the Target and Best Buy world and kind of the ecosystem, we were actually reaching out to different agencies and partners based out of Minneapolis. They're like, hey, like we've got this new kind of technology platform. We just integrated retailers you work with. How do we find a way to partner? And so that began organically, just the introduction into that group. And then what we figured out was, hey, there's probably a lot more opportunity here and maybe some really interesting things we could do if we were to partner together a little more closely. And then ultimately that turned into a conversation about acquisition. And then here we are today. So with The Stable, you know, they're heavily focused on Target and Amazon and Best Buy and Costco and Meijer and helping introduce new brands into those different retailers through a really awesome set of capabilities and services they offer. But one of the things they're looking to unlock for a lot of those brand partners is effectively like what we do. And so our work is very complementary and incremental to their business. And so the two of us together, we believe is definitely very unique offering for any brand who's trying to, you know, attack omnichannel retail across effectively all the major national and even large regional retailers. And so, yeah, together we've got I think just today a strong offering, but then surely we've got, a lot of plans and a vision for growing a new, type of omnichannel consumer brand agency.
Yeah, I'm wondering about you. I think you've got about 30 employees on the team there in the Rogers office who've helped you build the company. How did you share this exciting news with them about The Stable, and what was their reaction?
Sure. So we had some of our leadership team, and they were in the loop as we kind of progressed through some of these conversations. But ultimately, not everybody receives this news the same way, right?
Right.
So some people have had bad experiences with M&A activity, and so we were very mindful that, you know, this isn't just a celebration for everybody initially. So we actually broke the news the Monday after we signed, had some time for lots of Q&A we did anonymous Q&A. Like, we will answer every question you have about, you know, how this transpired and what you should expect. And so I think it the good news is with this deal, like it actually just makes a ton of sense. And it happened at a time where our business is growing.
And that's Billy Courtney, a co-founder of Rogers retail tech company Rich Context, which is being acquired by The Stable in Minneapolis. Both agencies will merge immediately with plans to completely operate under the Stable brand early next year. For more, be sure and read our story online at nwabusinessjournal.com. In other news this week, more M&A deal flow. A custom packaging company from the Pacific Northwest has a deal in place to buy Tango Press. It's a digital printing and packaging startup in Springdale. The Boxmaker, a manufacturer of digitally printed packaging based in Kent, Washington, says that deal should be completed by the end of 2020. Tango Press co-founder John Ballantyne will continue in a leadership role with the company, which will maintain the Tango Press business name for the immediate future. Fort Smith entrepreneur Luis Andrade has purchased the assets of Fayetteville-based charter company Jet Aircraft. Lance Creamer founded Jet Aircraft in 2011. He is now CEO and co-owner. Andrade is president and co-owner. And Springdale-based Tyson Foods says it will build and expand facilities overseas to increase its international production capabilities. On Monday, the company said it will expand its Raised and Rooted brand of plant-based and blended meat products to retail customers in Europe. For those stories and more, follow our daily reporting at both nwabusinessjournal.com and at talkbusiness.net. I'm Paul Gatling, and that is today's Northwest Arkansas Business Journal Report. Until next time, thanks for listening.
The Arkansas Razorback volleyball team will close out this odd 2020 season with a pair of home matches against Texas A&M in Fayetteville this weekend. Tomorrow night's action in Barnhill Arena begins at 7. The Saturday night contest is scheduled to start at 6. And that's it for home games on campus this weekend. The Arkansas soccer team, SEC regular season champs for a second consecutive year, will open play in the SEC tournament in Orange Beach, Alabama, on Tuesday. As the number one seed in the tournament, the Razorbacks skipped the first two rounds, and their opponent will either be Mississippi, Alabama, or LSU in the quarterfinals Tuesday evening at 6. Arkansas has never won the SEC tournament. They made it to the finals last year, but lost to South Carolina. The Walton Arts Center and the Walmart Amp are adding a pair of movies to the Saturday Cinema Series. The Greatest Showman will be shown Saturday, November 21st, beginning at 3 p.m. White Christmas, the one with Bing Crosby, will be shown Saturday, November 28th, also beginning at 3. Both movies will be shown in Baumwalker Hall at the Walton Arts Center in Fayetteville. Both are free with reservations. Every other row will be empty as a health precaution. Mask wearing and social distancing will be enforced for all patrons. Concessions will be cashless. You can find out more at waltonartcenter.org.
This is Leah Uribe, Associate Professor at the University of Arkansas Music Department, expanding our musical boundaries with Sound Perimeter. Blue is my favorite color. I love that blue hour right before sunset. The name of one of my dogs is Blue. And of course, summer blueberries. Blue being the tiny word for the show, we opened our segment today with the beginning of the iconic George Gershwin's Rhapsody in Blue, interpreted by Chinese pianist Lang Lang and the London Symphony Orchestra under the direction of John Axelrod. Rhapsody in Blue, originally titled American Rhapsody, was renamed as Rhapsody in Blue as suggested by George Gershwin's brothers Ira. It was premiered in 1924 and clearly opened the way for jazz to be mixed with the sounds of classical music and a big band. Since, Rhapsody in Blue has been one of the most performed pieces for piano and symphony orchestra from the American repertoire.
Thank you.
That was an excerpt from Gershwin's Rhapsody in Blue, interpreted by pianist Lang Lang and the London Symphony Orchestra under the direction of John Axelrod. Honoring the color blue, today I also want to share with you the orchestral piece Blue Cathedral by Philadelphia-born composer Jennifer Higdon. Jennifer Higdon is one of the most acclaimed and most frequently performed American living composers. She is a major figure in contemporary classical music, receiving the 2010 Pulitzer Prize in Music for her violin concerto and several Grammys since. Higdon wrote the one-movement orchestral composition Blue Cathedral in 1999, commissioned by the Curtis Institute of Music. The piece was conceived in memory of her brother, who died the year prior of cancer. In the program notes, Higdon says of Blue Cathedral, quote, "I began writing this piece at a unique juncture in my life and found myself pondering the question of what makes a life. The recent loss of my younger brother, Andrew Blue, made me reflect on the amazing journeys that we all make in our lives, crossing paths with so many individuals, singularly and collectively, learning and growing each step of the way. This piece represents the expression of the individual and the group, our inner travels and the places our souls carry us, the lessons we learn and the growth we experience." End quote. Let us listen to a passage from Jennifer Higdon's Blue Cathedral, performed by the Oberlin Conservatory Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Robert Spann. That was Jennifer Higdon's Blue Cathedral, interpreted by the Oberlin Conservatory Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Robert Spann. It is so refreshing to connect with music written by women composers. The music of Jennifer Higdon has a wonderful record of live performances, and I hope that trend is followed by many. It's about time. This is Leah Uribe, Associate Professor at the University of Arkansas Music Department, expanding our musical boundaries with Sound Perimeter. Before we go, how about an internationally acclaimed classical violinist who plays a Stradivarius, performing a little bluegrass? Here it is, Tessa Lark on her own composition, Appalachian Fantasy. See you again soon.
Tomorrow afternoon on the next Science Friday on KUAF, what does the transition to a new administration mean for the country's response to COVID-19? Plus, drugs, including marijuana, heroin, and mushrooms, were legalized in every state where they were on the ballot. Details on Science Friday, beginning at 1, tomorrow afternoon on 91.3 KUAF. And on tomorrow's Ozarks at Large, a recent survey indicates Americans, especially young Americans, know less about the Holocaust than Americans did just a decade earlier. And educators at Northwest Arkansas Community College want to change that. How historians and others at NWAC are working to make sure Holocaust awareness and knowledge are a fundamental part of all of our learning experiences. That and much more on tomorrow's Ozarks at Large at noon and 7 p.m. on 91.3 KUAF, also at ozarksatlarge.com, and by asking your smart speaker to please play Ozarks at Large.
Ozarks at Large is underwritten, in part, by the Walton Family Charitable Support Foundation. When caring for a seriously ill loved one, the journey shouldn't be taken alone. Circle of Life Hospice can help. Services are covered by Medicare, Medicaid, and private insurance. No one is turned away based on an inability to pay. 750-6632 or nwacircleoflife.com for more.
This is 91.3 KUAF, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Bentonville, and Baldwin. 91.3 KUAF, a listener-supported service of the J. William Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas. Contributors to our Thursday show this week included Daniel Carruth, Zuzana Sitek, who delivered news about the Siloam Springs School District, Leah Uribe, by the way, Sound Perimeter, produced by Lee Wood, and Paul Gatling from Talk Business and Politics. You can learn more about that at talkbusiness.net. Timothy Dennis produced today's show. We will be back, of course, with you tomorrow at noon and 7 for a Friday edition of Ozarks at Large. We are a podcast as well, absolutely free through all those major podcast distributors. From the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio at the Carver Center for Public Radio, I'm Kyle Kellums. Take care of yourself.